Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley here with you, and our guest this week is George McCrae, who had a super huge number one hit, Rock Your Baby. We're hearing the B-side, the instrumental version now. It's just such a fabulous, strange, catchy tune. And somebody pointed out that John Lennon's song, Whatever Gets You Through the Night, was sort of stolen from this. And apparently John Lennon was a top 40 radio listener in the 70s, listened all the time. And I guess that chord progression was, you know, just kind of running through his head. He had probably figured it out on the guitar and sort of came up with different lyrics. And if you listen to the last Saturday's radio show, you can hear I'm playing, I played a demo of John Lennon and the band running through an early arrangement of Whatever Gets You Through the Night. And indeed, in that demo, you really, really hear the similarity of the two chord progressions. It's pretty interesting. It's probably on YouTube. Check it out. Anyway, George McCrae, me, he's down in Aruba. He's moved to Holland, and Aruba is sort of a part of, like, some sort of colony of Holland. In fact, I went to Aruba a few years ago, and they've got pictures of the, I think there's still a king of Holland in a lot of the bars and restaurants. Kind of interesting. So, nothing much coming up. I'm working on a few things. You'd think people would be very available for interviews, but not. I think people, there's kind of a malaise happening. Anyways, me, George McCrae, and we're just talking here. Hope you enjoy it. So there is George McCrae, I'm Longing For You, from his album of a couple of years ago, titled Love. You know, quite a nice old school sound. We'll get to that later, but first I just want to say good morning. Hello, George McCrae, and I know it's kind of crazy times. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing quite well. Actually, I'm here in Aruba at the moment. I'm kind of tied down here because of the corona situation, and there's no flights going in and out, so but I don't mind it. I'm in my second home here, so it's okay.
Yeah, nobody feels too sorry for anybody stuck in Aruba. That's kind of like paradise.
Yes, it is. I'm Rival Island.
So I believe you were born in, or you grew up in West Palm Beach, Florida, the second of nine children, so a lot of brothers and sisters. Tell me about your childhood. What did your folks do?
Well, my mother was a domestic worker, but she also was a nurse at first. She worked for a doctor. And then she, my father was a policeman. He was the first black policeman in West Palm Beach back in the day.
And were they, you know, did they have music?
Well, of course, I grew up, with my mother and my father. They always loved music. My mother studied actually opera in school. She had a scholarship, I believe, to go to a university, you know, for a music scholarship. And, she came back because she found out she was pregnant from my father. That's a good long story. But thank God, because of that, I wouldn't be here. And then my father, yes, he was a policeman. They got married and everything, and he was in the U.S. Navy back in World War II. And then when he got out, he became a policeman. And yeah, first he was a policeman in Belgrade, Florida, and then in West Palm Beach in the early 50s. He became the first black policeman in West Palm Beach.
So what was the situation? I mean, I don't know too much about West Palm Beach, because Palm Beach is a super wealthy neighborhood. What's West Palm Beach like?
Oh, yeah, it is. It's a very super wealthy neighborhood. It's one of the, I think it's the richest county in the state of Florida. Mm. And this is where most of all of the aristocrats, the mayor of the post at the time, and the Kennedys and the Rockefellers, they had homes over in Palm Beach. And West Palm Beach was the other side, you know, but everybody worked in, was living in West Palm Beach. Majority of people worked in Palm Beach, and they had other businesses in West Palm Beach. So that was the whole center of Palm Beach County. And also it was an agriculture part, too. It was a large sugar cane and oranges. You name it, tomatoes. But I had a nice town there. We had I went to high school, Aruba High School, and it was a time when it was segregation there then. So I went to all black school before before integration started back in the, and when I graduated, it was in, I think, 1963.
Were you singing? Were you singing in church? What was your, when did you start singing?
Well, I started singing in church when I was 6 years old. My first song, it was a Christmas pageant, and my grandmother forced me to sing. I didn't want to, and she gave me a certain look, you know, how your grandma could look at you, and you have to do what you say. So I got up there, and I sung Silent Night. After I finished, people stood up and was clapping their hands. And it scared me so much, I ran back and jumped in my grandma's lap. I said, "Grandma, what's happening? You know, what's happening? People standing up." It scared me to death. She said, "No, they love you, they love you, they love you." So I think I'll call that my first standing ovation.
That's beautiful. That's fantastic. What a great way to start off.
Yeah.
This would be the early 60s. You were in high school, the late 50s, early 60s. Were you singing in groups and stuff like that?
Actually, I started singing. I had a group called Step Brothers in elementary school. We did little talent shows and stuff where I started singing like that. And also sung in the junior high school glee club. We had our school always had that, and we always had competition with other schools. And in high school, it was the same thing there, too. Then I formed a group in high school called the Jive and Jets, and we were singing all over the place, in small clubs, at night, you know, in special times, because they had a curfew then with teenagers.
They had a year-round curfew?
No, it wasn't a year-round curfew, but just for kids, you know, at a certain time to be in.
Huh.
In our neighborhoods back then, it was apartheid. You know, it had a Jim Crow law.
So, what was the curfew was just for African Americans, or was for all teenagers?
Yeah, for African Americans.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable. You know, and the police like going on right. What's going on right now? It was the same way then. Back then, we had to be in be out off the streets for a certain time, or the police will they beat you, take you to jail, or even maybe kill you.
Wow.
That's a different, nothing changed.
That's amazing. So go back to the Jive and Jets for a minute. Were you guys just covering whatever was on the R&B charts, or what was your sound?
Oh yeah, we were covering all the R&B charts. We were doing stuff by the Platters, the Drifters, Benny King. Oh yeah, a lot of stuff from the Atlantic artist era. And had to sing on the end, had to, all the doo-wop groups. Like, one summer night. One summer night and stuff like that, you know.
That's right.
A lot of Lil Nathan Imperial stuff. We did it, you know, to impress the girls. So it was fun.
So were you thinking as a, you know, as a older teenager or high school guy, maybe I would try to make music my career? Or was that thought in your mind?
No, not at all. That wasn't in my mind. I loved to sing a lot. After I graduated from high school, I joined the U.S. Navy.
Yeah, why'd you do that?
Because of the Vietnam War was getting ready to start. They were doing the draft. And the draft, you know, I didn't want to go to the Army because I didn't want to go to, foxholes and shoot up people and get killed myself. So I say my best choice is to join the Air Force or the Navy. And besides my father and my uncles, They was in the Navy.
So what was your job?
Aircraft maintenance administration man. I did all the bookkeeping for all the aircraft that our squadron had.
Where were you stationed?
I was stationed in Pensacola, Florida first. And then I was moved to, the next order went to Japan. And while I was in Japan for 18 months, and while I was in Japan, we were TDY'd to the Philippines and Vietnam. Carter's then during the Vietnam War, and we delivered the cargo, mail, parts, anything in water. We even flew back body bags, you know, to be shipped back home. You know, it was the time, but
yeah. So, how many years in the Navy total?
I spent 4 years.
Yeah. So when you got back pretty quickly, I think you married Gwen, your first wife. Tell me how you guys met and tell me.
I met Gwen while I was in the Navy. I met Gwen in 1964. I was stationed in Pensacola, Florida. And I met her there. We got married on August 29th, 1964.
Now, of course, she became a singer, and was she singing when you met her?
No, she wasn't. I'm the one who got her into singing.
Hmm.
When I got out of the Navy, because while I was in the Navy, I was singing in the Navy, too. I was singing in the clubs there and in the Philippines. You have your days off, you go into town, and in the clubs there and everything, they always had bands playing. You know, I used to get up there and just go jam with the bands. And I had a band up in the Philippines, a longphone. And I walked in the club, they were singing, "In the jungle, the quiet jungle, the lion sleeps tonight." They were playing that, you know, and they sound just like the record. I couldn't believe it. So I walked in, and so when they finished, I walked up to them and said, "Can I sing a song?" They say, "Don't speak English, don't speak English." I said, "But you just sang a song so perfectly, you know? How can that be?" I mean, there was the musicians spot on the sound. It's just like the real record. If you close your eyes, you can swear it was the same group. So I had to say, "Do you know Summertime?" And I started singing a song. They said, "Yeah." I said, "Replay." Then I started playing it. And I got up and started singing Summertime. I turned the place out. It was unbelievable. So every time I go back to the club, they'll come, "Boy song, sung boy song, sung boy song. Come sing, come sing, come sing." This asked all the time. So it was fun time during that time.
That sounds, I mean, I wish I had a time machine. I'd go back and check that out.
Oh, yeah, I believe it. I had a nice experience. And so after that, after my time was up, I returned back to the States in 1967, January 19th, I was mustered out. I came home, and I put my old group back together again. We started singing again, and we had lost one of the members in the Vietnam War, so I added Gwen to the group, and I knew she could sing.
Gotcha. And somehow, pretty quickly, you guys hook up with Henry Stone's Alston label, make a bunch of singles together and alone. Tell me about Henry Stone. I mean, that guy is like a legendary Florida music guy. His name is on so many records, so many deals. He had a hand in so many careers.
Oh, you better believe it. So many careers. James Brown, Ray Charles, you name so many. And I had no idea. I had no idea that he was that well-known, you know, that successful in the business. But so actually, they started like Betty Wright, bless her, she just passed away. Betty Wright was singing in the club called the Ebony Club. And a DJ by the name of Joe Fisher had booked her there. I met Betty's manager and producer, Willie Clark. And so Gwen and I was the opening act for Betty. And they heard her sing. And Willie Clark came over to me and said, "Man, we just started a record company there in Miami, in Hialeah. And I think we're looking for new talent. And I think you guys could be great, you know. Here's my phone number. Give us a call. You know, come down and have a meeting with us, because I think we could do something with you guys." So he gave his telephone number, and I didn't call him till a year later.
Yeah, it's awfully cool of you. I mean, that's amazing. So you were the opening act, and so you call him a year later, and what's he say?
We were working at a place in Fort Lauderdale then, called Leonard's Nightclub, and so I just thought about him, so I called him, because we were more closer to Miami then. So he said, I called him, and Brad Shapiro, who was living in Fort Lauderdale, he was a producer, also with the Alston label, along with Steve Alamo, came and saw us and said, "Yeah, you guys are great. Come and come tomorrow and sign the contract." I say, "What?" I was like, "Oh, what?" Just like that, you know. And so the next day we went down to the office and met Henry and Steve Alamo. And Steve Alamo was a star in his own right at the time, because he started on Red Action Is. It was a TV program at the time. And also it was a Dick Clark show. He owned a Dick Clark show that had a program too. Shindig or one of them, something like that. I think he was on there too. But it was, when I met him, I said, "Oh my God, Steve Alamo too. Oh." And Steve Lamo started producing us. He was the first producer that produced us.
Tell me a little bit about the nightclub scene in Florida. It seems like, you know, that area had more clubs than most areas have. What was it, a pretty vivid, vital scene down there?
Yeah, it was always a holiday place. You know, tourists coming down all the time in Miami.
And was it good money for those gigs?
Oh, yeah, it was good money. You know, we was working like six days a week. And back then, you know, it's a lot of money. You know, we were making like $800 a week. To me, that was a lot of money. You know, you're like 20, 21 years old.
Yeah.
And all you do is just say, and back then, you know, and the dollar was strong then. It's not like it is now, you know. $800 a day, you know, it's nothing. But back then, it was very, very, a lot of money.
What'd you spend your money on, young man like you?
Oh, yeah. You know, I was married, and I had a child, you know, had a daughter. And I bought a house. And, yeah, paying rent before. And
so no sports cars, no fancy jewelry?
No, all the sports car came after I had to hit Rock Your Baby.
Gotcha. Okay, good for you. So you guys are making records, and it's funny, some of them are produced by Clarence Reed, and you mentioned Willie Clark earlier, and there's some real interesting sounding records, and eventually those guys start having some hits like Funky Nassau and Clean Up Woman. You mentioned Betty Wright earlier.
Yeah.
So things start to heat up a little bit down there, and they've got, you know, some better luck, I guess. Tell me a little bit about Betty Wright, because obviously she's a real, you know, link in your career. Without her, there's no George McRae, sort of.
Correct.
You know, she just passed away. What kind of a lady was she?
Oh, she was fantastic. She was much younger than us at the time we met her.
Wasn't she just still a teenager when she had Clean Up Woman?
Yes, she was. At the time, yeah, when I was like 25, I think. And Willie Clark was her producer. And we started doing her better writing. We became the background vocals for TK Records and Austin Labels. Everything that was coming out of Austin, we were the background singers on the songs. Better Write, Gwen McCrae, and myself.
Right, so you guys are on tons of records singing background. Kind of interesting.
Yes.
Another thing that sort of happened right around this time is Clarence Reed he sort of has an alter ego, this guy, Blowfly, who made these weird X-rated kind of Zodiac, you know, whatever.
Yes.
Were you around for that? What was going on there?
Of course. Clarence Reed. Clarence wrote a lot of my first songs, too.
Yeah.
He's Up to Find My Baby, Back Dudes, was one of my first records.
I mean, tell me what your thoughts were about the whole Blowfly thing.
Oh, Blowfly. Back in those days, it was like, you know, I can't even say. he was funny. He was very creative, and he had his character, and Blowfly was like, a lot of records were sold under the order distribution for TK Records, and I can't say, but back then we called it dirty. He had a dirty mouth. He would take songs, you know, and put different words to them, and he used, you know, mother this, and, you know, and I can't, I don't want to say it on the radio, in a way, you know,
yeah.
But use your mind. He sold a lot of records.
Yes, he did, yeah.
He sold a lot of records that was Blowfly. And even before Richard Pryor.
Yes, they're absolutely the dirtiest records you can imagine. But yeah, they're pretty funny, I think. I mean,
yeah.
and some of them are pretty groovy records. I mean, there's some real great grooves on this record.
I saw the music, the beat and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So you also sing, this is another thing I didn't really know about. You guys are on Monkey Grip, the Bill Wyman from the Rolling Stones solo album. How did you get involved in that? You guys were just background vocals for Hire?
We were doing the background vocals for TK Records, so we were known for, if you want background vocals all over, just for Miami, Criteria Records too, Criteria Studios. So he came over to Criteria and doing this album there, and they needed background vocals, and first thing they called us to come do it.
And so were you hanging around a lot, or were you just in and out to do the session?
No, we came in, just did it in the day.
That's just another job.
Just another driver came and did in the neighborhood. Heard the album, you start putting, you know, arranging the back on vocal for it and ran it down.
Hmm. So at a certain point, you've put out all these singles, you've been playing in the clubs for years, and I take it that you were sort of going back and forth whether or not to sort of stay in show business or leave show business, and there's these two young kids who are now sort of in the family that that's making records with Henry Stone, and they have this demo that they've made, and it turns into Rocky Baby. It's Harry Wayne, Casey, and Richard Finch, the guys who have started this band called Casey and the Sunshine Band, and it's just a demo, and you go in there, and you sing this tune on the demo, and we all know that this record becomes giant. Do you remember that day when you cut those vocals?
Oh, yes, I do.
How long did it take?
I remember. I would never. Oh, it took me number about 3 minutes, the song. No, three minutes ten.
Is it one take?
One take. I did it in one take. And what happened was after I did my that. And so I did it three times. And Rick stopped and said, George, that last sing over that. I'm and hold that last longer. You know, so he was, take me on and rock me. Take me on and rock me. You say, hold as long as you can. I said, oh, well, I got it. Okay. He punched me in the end. That was the song.
It's kind of amazing. I mean, those guys were young guys, and this was only, I think, the fifth single on TK Records. And Casey and the Sunshine Band hadn't really had any big hits yet, or at all, really. They had a couple small singles, I think. So this really was a new sound that those guys were onto. Did you? I mean, it's such a. It's one of those records it's huge in so many ways. I mean, it was huge. It was, you know, for one thing, it sold all over the world, you know, which is,
yes,
I think,
yes.
That's a real specific kind of, and it's also one of the, there's less than 40 records ever that have sold more than 10 million physical copies, and that's one of them, which is, you know, absolutely amazing. And it reached number one, of course, on the Billboard chart, July 1974. I mean, you couldn't have had any idea, right? You'd cut so much in the studio over the years, you couldn't have had any idea this was going to turn into that, did you?
No, I had no idea at all. I just heard it was a new song, and I liked the way Casey and Rick was doing, because at the time, I was going to just give up singing because of my daughter. And in Florida at the time, I had a thing about giving me an 8-to-5 job, which I was working then anyway. I was singing part-time, and then plus working as a doorman. I've done so many jobs, you know, when I was singing, just to make ends meet. So singing was like a hobby for me at the time.
Let me remind folks that George McRae is our guest on today's program. So when a record sells 10 million copies, I mean, even
actually,
if you get...
it's not 10 million. That record has sold over 50 million.
Over 50. It's okay. So when a record sells over 50 million copies, even if you get, I don't know, one penny a record, that's $500,000. Were those guys cool with the money?
Unfortunately, no.
Oh, I had a feeling that was going to be the answer here. It's a giant hit, and those guys must have been rolling in money at a certain point. How does that work? Do you just have to kind of go into the office once in a while and say, "Hey, can I get some money?" How does that work?
At the time, the contract that I had with it at the time is like 3% of what it was. But my first check I received from TK was $100,000. And by that time, it's a long story. I'll try to make it short.
Okay.
Okay. I had no idea that Rock Your Baby would be successful like it was when I recorded it. We was having a great time in the studio, me, Casey, and Rick, when I did Rock Your Baby. And so at the time, Gwen had already did her album. She did it in Memphis. She cut there in the studio in Memphis and came back home. And I was down there to listen to her album that she did. And Casey came to me and said, actually, they have a song that Casey cut upstairs on Tibbin Tobin's organ that he finished recording with. And it's too high for him. He can't sing the song. He said, "Joe, but your voice is so good because you got that high voice. You can sing the song." So I had to get permission from Steve Alamo, because he was the executive producer of the whole thing. And so I went and asked Steve, "Rick and Casey got the song, and they want me to sing it. Steve, you owe me a lot of favors, man." He said, "Okay, George, do the song. Do it. You got it." So I got permission from Steve Alamo, and I went there and recorded Rockin' Baby, and I did it in one take. But before I recorded Rockin' Baby, I took the track home, and I listened to it with his own cassette. And I asked my mother, you know, how would you like a band to sing to you? So my mother told me, and I asked my sisters, and I asked my sister's girlfriends, you know, how you like a man to sing to? You know, so I thought about it, and so I put my own combination together. I said, yeah, that's what it is. And so I thought of my favorite artists. I loved them since my day one. I met him when I was 16 years old. I loved the singing, and I shook his hand. I never forgot it. He let me shake his hand. And that was Sam Cooke. And then my second artist I really loved was Smokey Robinson. His voice, you know, Motown.
Yeah. So you're kind of doing a little bit of channeling both of those guys.
Yeah. I did channel both of the guys, put the feel to, you know, feel in there. But I was able to do it, George McRae, though, my feeling, though.
Sure.
But I had to be mine. And on the end of it, believe it or not, my second, but that last part, when I grew up playing, I used to be a kid playing all the time. I used to play Tarzan. And that's the beating rule. And so I just, you know, when I was doing Rockin' Baby, I said, I'm going to put my Tarzan yell in there. Take me in your arms and rock me. Take me in your arms and rock me.
I had no idea. That's amazing.
That was all in that one take, you know, that three minutes I had to sing Rockin' Baby, that song.
So tell me, just to get back to the money, can you wind that up? What happened to the money?
Well, after I made a lot of money. I went to my first tour. I went out with James Brown because I got a phone call Rockin' Baby. So I was opening act for that time.
I got a question for you. This is 1973, 74. Was the word disco, did that word exist?
No, it started. Rockin' Baby was the first disco song, because it made people dance. And that song, that started, DJs would take Rockin' Baby and play it, and if they wanted people on the floor to dance, they would play a song, and the floor would just pack, boom, on the floor, automatically. They played other songs, but everybody was against the wall, you know. But soon as Rockin' Baby came out, the whole floor was full. It was that catalyst to start a whole new revolution in music.
Yeah. You got nominated for a Grammy Award Best Male R&B Singer the next year. Did you go to the Grammys?
No, I didn't. I was in Europe at the time. I didn't go. Hmm. And I was, that's a long story, too. Well, I could write a book, but...
Maybe you should. So is there any other great stories from the days of touring when that record, I mean, I know you were on a lot of TV shows and all that kind of stuff, but from touring the clubs, was there any other great stories from that time? I mean, having a huge hit record like that, it's an unreal experience, I assume.
Yep. My first experience was when I went to, I took Gwen with my ex-wife with me too. And I found out that was a big mistake when I did that. So I was learning how to go on there. It was my music, my record, and everything, you know. But she was acting like it was her record.
She had a huge hit with Rockin' Chair, which is almost like a sequel to Rock Your Baby in '75.
You know, can I tell you a story of that too?
Sure.
I was in she was with me in the studio, and I was at the microphone to sing Rockin' Chair because it was written for me. And I decided to, because I was having problems with my ex-wife at the time, so I figured if I give her a hit record, too, that, you know, she would, you know, she could mellow out a little bit. And so I called this thing and said, I want you to sing this. And so I co-produced it. I told her how to sing the song, and that was me. You know, I added a background vocals to it. Rock, 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 and that was me also going, oh.
Yeah.
That's me.
That's clearly you. That's like your trademark, yeah.
Yeah, that was my trademark. So I put that in there too, and I co-produced it. But when I did it, I played it for Steve and everything, and they did not give me credit for it.
It's interesting because in 1975, Gwen has her hit with Rockin' Chair, Casey and the Sunshine Band breakthrough with Get Down Tonight, and like the whole world kind of goes disco crazy. And then you got to make your follow-up record, and you make it with Casey and those guys again. Was there tremendous pressure for you to follow it up?
No, not at all. All my songs I've done with Casey and Finch is all one take.
Wow.
Every song I've done with them, I all did in one take.
That's totally mind-blowing. Yeah, that's so. You have a couple more top 10 singles, and like you said, you got a divorce, and you kind of moved around, and you know, you kind of been making records pretty steadily. When did things sort of, you know, you even put out records in the 80s. When did things for you? Did you think, wow, music has just changed too much for me, or was there a time when you decided to get out of it?
No, there was a time I decided to get out because I was touring a lot. And what happened was when that situation happened in Chicago, and when they started saying disco is dead.
Oh, when they wanted to burn the records in Chicago.
Burning all the records and, you know, and they wanted to kill disco, you know. So that made me pretty kind of angry because it was a time when, really, no, the disco time was a time of love and happiness and love. Everybody danced, everybody was being, you know, being carefree and peace. And I thought it was you know, the government had a lot to do with it because of people that want to fight. They want to make love and dance, you know, the baby boomers and all that. So they had to find some kind of way to break that all up and change the course of not having Keith and give them, and make them more aggressive music.
Yeah, you're right. I think maybe after Vietnam War and things, people just wanted to not, nothing too serious, and that was disco. But then, yeah, that sort of had its time and then kind of went away. But of course, your record always, you know, kind of, it's just always been there. It's just one of those records. It'll never go away. So tell me, eventually you wound up in the Netherlands. How did you wind up there as your home base?
Well, I was touring Europe at the time. And back in, I started touring again back in 1984. That's when TK Records back in, and the Stone came back into business because he went bankrupt. And in 1984-85, and then I gave him the Stone a phone call because I wanted to ask him about my royalties and about the catalog because he had sold my catalog to Morris Levy.
Oh, dear.
And I called Morris Levy. You know, when I found out, I called Morris Levy. And I asked for my royalties. He said, "Well, you're not getting any royalties. You better not call here again either." Just like that, and I did not call again.
Oh dear, that is incredible! Wow, that's amazing. So when eventually, I know that, like, you know, when Morris Levy died and his stuff, I think eventually the TK stuff went to Rhino Records. Did you finally start getting paid what you should?
Yes, I started. Yeah, yes, I did. Went to Rhino Records and went to EMI in Europe, and I started getting paid.
That's incredible.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're kind of, it's funny, I was just watching on YouTube you on the Jules Holland special where you're singing Rock You Baby, and I'm amazed that you can still hit every note just about. I mean, is it hard work or are you just lucky that you still have that instrument?
No, it's no luck. I just have that voice. I still get to it. Ah, hey! Ah!
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? No. It's my voice.
It's amazing. Yeah, it's and it's just fun. You can see the looks on people's faces. They're going crazy. I mean, when you sing that song, people go crazy. Am I right?
Yes, they do. This song is, it's an evergreen. I mean, it's my bread and butter song, and I've been blessed with that one big hit, and it's still just unbelievable, a classic. And I still receive emails from fans on my Facebook page, on my, you know, on my website, all over, you know, and they just tell, and young fans, new kids, you know, it's unbelievable. Just like 18, 17, 15 fans, you know, about and writing about and want an autograph, and can you send a picture of yourself, and you know, it's, I still get that.
Yeah, it's a very special record, and I totally understand.
And it's from all over the world.
You know, to start off the interview, I played something off of your most recent album called Love, and I'll be honest with you, George. Usually when an artist like you puts out a new record, I kind of hold my nose because I'm thinking, oh, no, this is going to be a disaster, you know what I mean? But this is a great record with, you know, the sounds are, it's just a real classic sense. It's just like your perfect George McRae thing, just updated a little bit. And I'm pleased to note that your daughters sing the background vocals on that record. So I know that you're still going, and I know folks can go to georgemcrae.com. If the world ever opens up again, I assume you'll be out there touring again?
Yes, I will. As long as I have my health and strength, I will be touring again. Hey, what else am I going to do?
That's true. What else are you going to do? We need to hear Rock You Baby one more time, and I never get sick of this record. Can you help me explain the groove of this song? Because there is a strange interaction, like a formula. There's not that many instruments on here, but the way that they're all playing together is just, you know, that's, I think, the secret of this record. Of course, your vocals, but there's just something so groovy about it. What's going on this record?
Well, the groove thing about it is that's Casey Erwin, Casey and Rick Finch. That's Rick Finch playing the bass and Casey playing the keyboards, and Rick then played the drums on it. And then it was the organ from Timmy Thomas, the Rhythm Ace organ, mm-hmm. Lowry organ at the time, with the pop the pop the pop the dum pop the pop the pop, and that's in where the Casey played the organ. It's only actually on this album, there's only two people who did all the tracks. That were Casey and Rick, and then the guitar. Then they brought in Jerome Smith to overdub. And Jerome was, you know, he was one of the best guitarists, young boy that played his own style, and he just laid back there. We just grew with it, you know.
Was he the guy from Casey and the Sunshine Band?
Yeah, he was from Casey, and Rocky Bay was cut before Casey and the Sunshine Band was formed in 1975.
Yeah, that guitar player doesn't quite get the notoriety he should. I mean, that guy invented a whole thing, you know, that kind of groovy guitar playing.
Unfortunately, he passed away. He died by a car accident.
Ah. Let me ask you, when you play this live, I'm sure as you travel around the world, sometimes you have to use a band that's, you know, a local band. Is it hard to get them to get this groove just right, or do people just fall into it?
No, people just fall into it. Because I'm there to show them what, you know, how to do it. Sometimes you find a guitar player that's a little off sometimes because he can't really play like Jerome Smith. But they come close to it, though.
Well, I want to remind folks they can go to georgemcrae.com for information, and hopefully you'll be hitting the road one of these days. And I want to thank you for sharing your story with us. It's just what a crazy story it is. You know, it's just amazing. What a great record. Well, let's hear Rock You Baby. I once again, just thank you so much, George.
Well, thank you for having me on your show, and what can I say? Thank you very much, Michael. Bye-bye.